Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, we're going to dig into some Celtics talk here in a bit, maybe try to figure out how we can get them over the hump in the Eastern Conference. But first, we have a battle between NBA heavyweights, former and current, in LeBron James versus Charles Barkley. It's just tearing up the internet right now, so we thought we'd weigh in. But first, I want to tell you why yesterday's Cleveland loss to Dallas was the ultimate told-you-so game for LeBron James.
I'm really curious because first of all, it's amazing that they lost to the Mavs, and it's amazing that they've been this bad this month. Although, shout out to Seth Curry. He has been really solid for Dallas, and I think there are like 15 different teams that are pissed off that they didn't sign him this summer. He could have helped all kinds of different contenders, but tell me about the game. I was watching Wolves Magic, missed the Cavs entirely, so fill me in.
Yeah, so, you know, LeBron had already kind of stated his case against management. We talked about that last week. By the way, if anyone didn't hear our podcast, it went up late Friday. Be sure to check it out. We really kind of ripped into the Bulls. That's a side note. So LeBron stated his case, and it was basically, why aren't we using all these roster spots? Why don't we have an extra ball handler to kind of help through some of these injuries? And he kind of was putting pressure on ownership and management to step up a little bit. Well, they get into the fourth quarter. Midway through the fourth quarter, LeBron has already logged 37 minutes. So Ty Lue decides, okay, we're going to take him out here for a quick rest and try to get him back in, right? They're down 12 to the Dallas Mavericks, who you mentioned are not very good. And you saw what Rick Carlisle said about his own squad last night, right?
Yes, I think his exact words were, we're a shit team, but we're an underrated shit team, which I loved. I think I'm a Mavericks fan now.
It's a brilliant quote. So LeBron's sitting for basically like 30 seconds in the middle of the fourth quarter. And as he's sitting, Dallas is just blowing out this lead. And who is blowing out the lead while LeBron's on the bench? The unheralded, you've probably never heard of, Yogi Ferrell. Now, Yogi Ferrell was picked up by Dallas on a 10-day contract earlier this week. His previous NBA experience, if you want to call it NBA experience, was being a member of the Brooklyn Nets earlier this season. Past that, he has no credentials.
Well, so hold on. Yogi Ferrell is a favorite in the Sports Illustrated offices. We work with like three different IU grads who are all way too high on Yogi Ferrell. So I'm happy for them because Indiana kind of sucks this year, but at least Yogi Ferrell is living the dream here.
Yeah, well, those same guys would probably pick Victor Oladipo in a redraft of the last like 10 NBA drafts, number one overall. So
yeah, fair.
Okay. Now, Yogi Ferrell is extending the lead here as LeBron sits. And just imagine for a second being in LeBron's chair, where you're watching your team completely, you know, fall apart without you. Kevin Love's injured yet again. You're getting lit up by a D-League call-up, basically, equivalent. You know, I mean, a 10-day contract guy who your team could have signed after you were just complaining that you guys don't have any backup ball handlers in depth last week. And by the way, you don't ever get to go back into the game because the lead got blown out, so your coach just punts it. So you've logged 37 minutes in a game that you lose to a terrible team in a month of losing. You don't even get to play crunch time, and you get slayed by a 10-day contract guy. And by the way, your team still hasn't signed anyone, and apparently they're holding a mini camp for the likes of Lance Stephenson and Kirk Heinrich. And maybe they'll be able to scrape together some of those guys from that 3-on-3 basketball league that's been getting some noise, you know, Ice Cube and so forth.
Right.
So can you understand why LeBron would be in told-you-so mode or incredibly frustrated after that game?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we can all sympathize to some extent. And as you said, Roger Mason Jr. is available if you need somebody. But I am, like we talked about the bench last week, I'm not as concerned as I guess LeBron James is about Cleveland, but all of it was prelude last night to LeBron just going off on Charles Barkley. And I wrote about this today in a different piece, but I was basically saying, like, I was up at 3 a.m, just like couldn't sleep, scrolling through Twitter. I actually downloaded a sleep podcast for I was listening to Sounds of the Ocean, and that wasn't working. And then finally...
Oh, no, 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 no. You got to go white noise. Trust me on this. White noise is the way to go.
Yeah.
And then actually get the white noise app and then download the brown noise sound. You'll be good. Trust me.
I'll check it out. I mean, Stormy Beach was not getting it done for me last night. But then my man, Dave McMenamin, who is awesome, and people don't... Little known fact, he was the one who started Gilbert Arenas' blog back in the day, so he's always cool with me. He drops this interview with LeBron that is just like, I don't think I've ever seen LeBron go off like this in more than a decade now.
It was pretty unusual by LeBron standards. I mean, which was your favorite part? Because he really dissected Charles Barkley. This was like probably 7 or 8 years worth of grievances just unloaded in one go. A little, you know, side swipe of Phil Jackson just for fun. And then, you know, a nice needy tweet to kind of top it all off at the end as sort of like the cherry on top of the dessert, which I liked.
Yes.
But what was your favorite line or your favorite angle that he goes at Charles?
Well, you're asking me for my favorite line as if we're not going to go through it line by line and discuss this. We don't have anything else to do today, and this is all pretty hilarious and amazing. So I think we need to start with the actual comments from Barkley. So last week on Inside the NBA, and you can look up a clip of this. We probably should have done that before this show, but you can look it up. He got into a big fight with Shaq after sort of going after LeBron for what he's been saying about David Griffin. Anyways, Barkley says, inappropriate, whiny, all of the above. The Cleveland Cavaliers, they have given him everything he wanted. They have the highest payroll in NBA history. He wanted J.R. Smith last summer, they paid him. He wanted Iman Shumpert last summer, they brought in Kyle Korver. He's the best player in the world. Does he want all of the good players? He don't want to compete? He is an amazing player. They're the defending champs. So that's basically the gist of what Barkley said for, I mean, he talked on and off about it all night. And basically, Barkley is saying, your team is already stacked. You have no right to be complaining here. And LeBron's response, initially he took the high road and said, whatever Barkley's saying is good for ratings. But here, last night, he begins by saying, he's a hater. What makes what he says credible? Because he's on TV? So I think it's important to point out that Barkley is one of the 30 best players in NBA history. And it's not like he skipped Bayless, but I do appreciate LeBron doing his best to turn him into Skip Bayless in the NBA world. I think that's what's happening here.
Yeah, I didn't like that part actually at all. I thought that was LeBron's weakest point. I think we can agree generally on Charles Barkley's credibility. And also, I think we can agree on his needling tendencies, right? Like, it's not like he's singling out LeBron for criticism, especially when it comes to guys teaming up and or going at, you know, quality, talented teams. I mean, I think that's Barkley's job, right? Because otherwise, we all sit around and marvel at Golden State's amazing ball movement. If somebody doesn't, you know, find some weaknesses to kind of poke and prod at, it gets kind of boring. And clearly, he feels like he's the poker and prodder in chief of that team. And so I think it's a calculated thing from Barkley. I think he's incredibly credible, both from a basketball standpoint and just a media commentator standpoint. I think most people would agree he's one of the best sports television personalities in any sport anyway,
yeah,
right?
Totally. I mean, if this is, I feel like NBA Twitter, there's this particular segment of like hardcore basketball fans who just loathe Charles Barkley. And that's fine. I get it. A lot of his analysis is kind of lazy and he can antagonize people by being deliberately lazy. So I understand if that pisses people off. But I think it's important to note, number one, that he's like really entertaining, and a lot of casual basketball fans who don't spend all day reading about basketball and coming up and like, who a lot of casual basketball fans who aren't fluent in like advanced statistics and where the game is now enjoy Charles Barkley, and he's good for the game in general, in my opinion anyways. And again, he's one of the 30 best players ever. He knows his shit. So with that said, I really enjoy LeBron just letting loose here. I feel like we should be playing the Ether beat as we read this. I'm not going to let him disrespect my legacy like that. I'm not the one who threw somebody through a window. I never spit on a kid. I never had an unpaid debt in Las Vegas. I never said, I'm not a role model. I never showed up to All-Star Weekend on Sunday because I was in Vegas all weekend partying. All I've done for my entire career is represent the NBA the right way. 14 years, never got in trouble. Respected the game. Print that. So what was your reaction?
Well, he just went from 0 to 100 really quick. I thought that this was a much more effective line of attack on Barkley because it gets to what I think bothers a lot of NBA players about Barkley, which is sort of do as I say, not as I did, right?
100%.
And there's a certain level of hypocrisy in sort of how Barkley likes to lecture. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, Barkley, I think, casts himself in this sort of father figure or older brother type figure role.
Yeah.
And these dudes don't want that. They're good, you know? they either have their own fathers or they don't need an extra father. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think that's where some of that's coming from. And everything that he said is factual and accurate, and it's out there in the public. I didn't think he crossed the line, really, by raising some of these things. Barkley understands that, you know, he's a public figure and he's got to be judged by his own past actions. I would be very surprised if he, you know, came back and tried to criticize LeBron for bringing any of that up. I thought it was all fair game.
Yeah, I mean, here's one of the things I noticed is he did not bring up the DUI arrest with some pretty embarrassing details over the last, I think it was like 5 years ago or something, which tells me that LeBron was very much in control of all this and was this was not
oh, this
like
was
a,
scripted.
Yeah, this was not scripted, a rant, right? You know, like he knew exactly what he was doing and he walked up to the line but did not really cross it to where it was too personal, to where people might have felt uncomfortable, because like you said, all this stuff is in public. And and look, here's why I kind of enjoy this from LeBron is like he's taken so much heat over the years for stupid things and so much baseless criticism, and some of it he's deserved, but like it is really true that he's been under the microscope his entire career and has never really made a mistake and has represented the game as well as anyone could have possibly imagined when he came into the league like 14 years ago or whatever it was. So
yeah, it's crazy to imagine LeBron spitting on a kid, you know? Yeah,
exactly. And it's also crazy to imagine if he had ever done like anything close to that, the entire world would have freaked out and sort of lost its mind. So I get him being resentful. And the resentments continue here. Go watch the 93 finals when John Paxson hit the shot. Barkley and Jordan were laughing and joking with each other during one of the games while somebody's shooting a free throw in the finals. But oh, nobody was friends back then. Good point, LeBron. Fair enough.
People have gone back to that one previously. And I also want to point out that in this quote, he happens to mention John Paxson hitting the shot. Was that a little bit at Mike for not shooting?
Maybe. I think it might have been a shot at Barkley for losing additionally.
Oh, I think it was. I mean, Barkley's clearly in the crosshairs, but LeBron's also kind of catching these strays around the side, you know? And I kind of thought when I read that, it was like, well, he just wanted to remind people that, you know, Jordan did pass on a couple of those finals winning shots.
Yeah. Speaking of strays, next quote. I went to see Melo at the Garden 2 years ago when we were in New York. They played Portland. I went up to a suite at halftime and Phil Jackson didn't say one word to me. I'm here to win ball games and take care of my teammates and take care of my, what's the word? Oh, my posse. So like, out of left field, we're talking about Phil Jackson again. LeBron is clearly not over that. And again, I think here, like, given how accomplished he's been and how well he's represented the game, like, he's perfectly valid in thinking it's bullshit that Phil Jackson wouldn't shake his hand.
Yeah, I wanted the full rant on Phil Jackson when I was, if there was one thing I was missing, you know how he just tore down Barkley's personal history piece by piece. I mean, given Phil's recent track record in New York, there's a lot of material, you know? I mean, he could have gone further. He hired Derek Fisher. He still was employing Kurt Rambis. I mean, there's so much juicy stuff LeBron could have gone to, and he just kind of played the, well, he's afraid to say it to my face card, which, you know, I can understand why he would feel disrespected by that as well.
Yeah, well, he was saving it for this, his version of hit him up. And next quote, this is actually kind of the meanest one. I know he wanted to retire a long time ago, but he can't. He's stuck up on that stage every week. I think LeBron just called Charles Barkley broke, right?
I don't think that's necessarily where he was going with it. Was it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've read this a couple times, and I don't know what he means if he's not talking about Charles Barkley being broke.
Like, why? I guess when I read that, it was like he was addicted to that role, or he needed that validation, or it was one of those things where, you know, part of him says he wants to just go live this quiet life, but the rest of him is just like he's so deep into being that person that he can't be it anymore? Or am I reading this way too philosophically?
I think maybe there's some of that there. I do think it might have just been a subliminal, like, yeah, you can't retire because you're broke, which might be crossing the line. But again, I'm enjoying Keep It Real LeBron. And if this makes him want to talk to me, the schedule's out there. He knows every road arena I'll be in. Don't just come up to me at All-Star and shake my hand and smile.
Well, I think what LeBron is really doing a nice job of here is reminding people that he is a person, you know, and there is this giant aura and this superstar thing that's surrounded him for a really, really long time. And he doesn't often completely expose his feelings. He loves these mind games that we call, you know, Da Vinci Code LeBron, or however you've dubbed it, where you're trying to just determine what really motivates him. I felt when I read that part, a little bit of damaged, right? Like he feels like people aren't respecting his feelings, that he's a person too, and that they're just looking at him as this machine that wins titles and does everything the right way and doesn't, you know, react to what people are saying about him.
Yeah. I think that's actually a good takeaway from this, is that LeBron is human and clearly it's in kind of a dark place right now. But he's also free to be honest. And again, he's free to be pissed off after all this stuff.
So after we've read through all of those, can we power rank our favorite lines? I got to say the John Paxson line was my favorite.
Yeah, I think that's up there.
Also, the rundown of all of Barkley's off the court stuff, I was in on. I like that too. That'd be number two for me.
I was shocked because, like, of all the people that Barkley has gone after, like, no one has ever just emptied a clip in response and said, "Look, you've done this, 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 and this. You can't say a word to me." And so it was amazing. And I think my favorite is, I'm tired of the last line in McMenamin's story. "I'm tired of biting my tongue. There's a new sheriff in town." I think we just witnessed the dawn of Sheriff LeBron, a whole new era. Kind of, this is a new generation's version of, like, grumpy old man Kobe. And I'm here for it. I'm excited.
Yeah, I remember how disorienting it was once Kobe really decided to just completely let loose. Everyone just kept looking around at each other. Like, wait, does he realize he's on the record right now? I mean, there was that very clear, like, line of demarcation where he decided just not to have any more cares in the world. LeBron's getting to that stage, you know, probably 3 or 4 years earlier, which hopefully that's not a sign that he sees the end coming more quickly.
Yeah, I also enjoy, "There's a new sheriff in town" is a pretty corny line to drop the mic on, but that's always been LeBron. He's always kind of goofy and not quite cool. And this one, like, so I like that he's still retaining that corniness even as he transitions. So big picture, I think this is a feud that will end, like, pretty quickly, right?
I mean, if you're Barkley, you have to take the loss. I mean,
I think that's one of the reasons Barkley is good, is that when he's wrong, he is generally pretty cool with admitting that he got it wrong.
Well, what's he going to say? "I didn't throw somebody through a window." I mean, he can't really, like, undo this. You know, we got police reports here. We got the receipts, you know?
Yeah.
Here's my question, though. When LeBron mentions the legacy word, and Barkley said some things in the past about how maybe LeBron can never be a top five player or stuff like that, how much do you think that is behind this broadside attack too? Because LeBron's really made that a central argument, right? That he believes he's got to be in the conversation, the Mount Rushmore, you know, and then he said he's chasing Jordan. He told Lee Jenkins that last summer. How much do you think that some of the personal frustration, which clearly came out, I mean, this was personal, man-to-man type stuff, how much do you think that was, "Hey, I'm staking my spot here among the all-time greats. I'm obviously better than you were, Charles, but you got to start talking about me right there with Michael Jordan. How much do you think that was part of it? Because he did mention the word legacy.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think that definitely plays into it. And of all the things, like, I actually think that Barkley is pretty much correct about what he said about LeBron. Like, LeBron, the Cavs are so stacked that he's not really in a position to complain. And especially if, like, this is all about a backup point guard. And look, like Mario Chalmers or Lance Stephenson.
It's not though. I mean, we know it's about more than that. Like, one thing I was looking at today is just like how many minutes has LeBron been logging, right?
And, all right, but hold on. I don't think LeBron plays those minutes unless LeBron wants to play those minutes.
Well, I disagree because I think that they're playing him for whatever reason out of desperation, because as soon as he leaves the court, they get lit up by Yogi Ferrell. And I think that they're looking around and asking him to solve all the problems. Like, for example, he's played more 40-minute games this year than all of the major MVP candidates, whether it's Harden or Westbrook, guys who are significantly younger than him.
No, he's leading the league in minutes. I mean, it's ridiculous how much he's played this year. But
But it's coming in these heavy doses. So he's playing way more than the MVP favorites who are younger than him. He's playing way more 40-minute games than his age peers, guys like Melo or whoever else, Chris Paul you want to throw in there. They're basically never getting to 40 anymore. And he's playing way more than the Warrior stars who kind of only get there if it goes to overtime, right?
Yeah.
So he's out on an island. Basically, the only other guys who are up there are like Anthony Davis and Kyle Lowry. And I think Anthony Davis in New Orleans, we understand why he's doing that. They've got no other hope. And then Kyle Lowry, that's been kind of an issue with in Toronto, where people are saying they got to rest these guys more often because they tend to hit a wall midseason. So he's kind of on the wrong side of history, Ty Lue is, when it comes to managing LeBron's minutes. So it's not just about this backup point guard going in there for 5 minutes a night. You
yeah,
know? It's about more than that.
If you believe that Ty Lue is making that decision independently of LeBron, then I support that theory. I just kind of feel like LeBron at this point has a little bit more control over how often he's playing. So,
well, last year he played 13 times. He had 40 minutes in the entire season. This year he's already at 12. So he's on pace basically for 21. So he's going to almost double the number of times he's played that heavy of a load. To me, that is a Band-Aid type thing, like we're making it up as we're going along. Okay, LeBron, get back out there and do this for us.
Yeah.
And I also think you get into situations with your rotation where, like, if you front load LeBron's minutes like they have been, I mean, he's always going to be playing down the stretch, right? So it's easier to kind of have that damage when you're feeling like, you know, at times when guys like Kevin Durant and Westbrook are taking longer breaks earlier in the games, LeBron just isn't. And so anytime they're in a close game, LeBron's minute tally is going to be huge because he's always going to play down the stretch. So, you know, to me, he never wants to come out of a close game late, right? And that's kind of how you kind of manage this. But I think it's on Ty Lue's rotations, frankly.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's fair. We disagree on that point. But I think bigger picture, Chuck's point about what LeBron said is at least a debate. Like, you can agree with Barkley without being ridiculous. You can agree with LeBron without being ridiculous. But to go back to what we were originally talking about, like, legacy-wise, it's ridiculous to say that LeBron does not belong, at least in the conversation, for one of the five greatest players ever. And Barkley was like flat wrong about that. And it doesn't really make sense that he's so reluctant to sort of like recognize that in LeBron. And if that's what this is about, that's totally valid.
Okay, but here's the defense of Barkley. And it's something that I constantly feel when we're doing these rankings of, you know, the top 100 players.
Yeah.
When you're an outside observer and you have that kind of a pulpit, you want guys to earn it. Barkley doesn't want LeBron to retire in the conversation with Michael Jordan as the greatest players of all time, right? Uh-huh. Barkley wants LeBron to retire as the greatest player of all time because he loves basketball and he wants to see greatness. I don't believe in his heart that Barkley is his pure hater. I think that if LeBron was able to go 7-0 in the finals, have better stats all the way across the board than Jordan, Barkley would give him his credit for it. I believe that.
Maybe that's true.
You want the guys to earn it, and Barkley's job is to push him. And frankly, it worked. I mean, all Barkley said was he was inappropriate and whiny, and the Cavs take pretty good care of him.
Yeah.
I mean, those are, you know, not the biggest shots of all time, right? And
totally.
LeBron responds with a complete haymaker. So clearly Barkley did his job here.
Out of nowhere. Yeah. So, all right. big picture, LeBron versus Barkley, I am not choosing a side in this one because I appreciate that Charles Barkley is an NBA commentator who's not afraid to sort of poke guys and criticize like star players and great teams. And I think that the NBA discourse kind of could use more of that, and he's willing to mix it up. So I enjoy Barkley, and I enjoy LeBron just going off like this. I think the last time we heard him in this mode was after that first finals loss when he told everyone to go back to their miserable lives. And since then, he's been pretty diplomatic, and which is probably for the best, but I enjoy him sort of, I don't know, going into ether mode here.
Yeah, and I think that these comments are a lot more deserving and defensible from LeBron than those comments were, right? Because that time he was kind of attacking down, going at the fans and going at people who had legitimate grievances or analysis of his shortcomings in that series.
Yeah, but so here's why I enjoyed it. And frankly, at the time, I didn't. because at the time, I was not a huge LeBron fan, and like most of America was rooting against him. But it goes back to what you were saying earlier. Like, LeBron is human, and I enjoy these moments where he kind of snaps because so much of his career has felt like an extended exercise in branding. And like I wrote this once, it feels like a lot of times he'll give interviews as if he's like talking in the middle of his own biopic. And this was real. And that press conference after the finals was real.
Yeah, the difference to me, though, is that they're both real for sure. This one's just a lot less misguided. I mean, the last one during the finals, it was just like, no, dude, like you played very poorly down the stretch of that series. You have to own that. And he didn't want to own it publicly. He didn't want to take his loss. He was pissed that, you know, media members like Greg Doyle of CBS were trolling him in the press conference. And he just couldn't get over that. And he couldn't really believe that it had played out how it happened. You know, I was there. He just did. He didn't want to take his loss.
Were you at those finals?
I was.
Man, that was one of the biggest mistakes I've made in journalism is I had a chance to go to those finals and I did not like LeBron at the time again. And so I was like, I don't really want to go down there and watch the Heat win a title and blow out the Mavericks. So I missed one of the greatest finals of all time.
He just didn't want to take his loss. And I think in this situation, he's much more justified in his comments. I mean, number one, like you said, it's very calculating. You know, there's almost like a Marlowe vibe from The Wire to this, where he's just like going down his checklist of things he wants to raise as debate points. And it's all fair game. And he's attacking somebody who is on his level. He's not attacking a fan. He's not attacking some random person. You know, he's attacking a major figure in the NBA, and he didn't fire first. And so for all those reasons, I think while both were, you know, quote unquote real in terms of actual expressions of his emotion, I'm much more with LeBron's response here than I was last time. And it goes back to accountability for me. Surprise, surprise. I just didn't think he was accountable in that finals for his own play.
Yeah.
I think here he's making it very clear. He's doing his job. He's doing everything he's supposed to be doing, and actually more, frankly, this season. And I think, you know, that's where these comments are coming from.
Yeah. Well, we can end it there. I'm really excited to see Inside the NBA on Thursday night, and we'll see where this goes.
Well, I have a question for you, though. Do you think that Barkley actually is a hater or not?
I do think that sometimes he will go out of his way to, I mean, it's not interesting when you're on TV every week to say, you know, LeBron is one of the greatest players ever. Like, it's not interesting to never question the best players in basketball, whether that's the Warriors, whether that's LeBron. So I think sometimes he will sort of mix it up just for the sake of mixing it up, and just because it's boring to sit on TV every week and say the same things. And so he's kind of shooting from the hip sometimes, let's put it that way. I don't think it's because he's like a hater. He's not Skip Bayless.
And when you look at what he said about the Warriors, you know, they never win a title. And those guys, I mean, they reacted, but never quite like this.
Yeah.
What do you make of that contrast between sort of how LeBron has just decided, like, enough is enough, and the Warriors are more in the role of, like, oh, we're light years ahead. We're, like, cruising above your petty little commentary because we're so much smarter than you. I mean,
I think
which approach would you prefer?
I think more than anything else, it speaks to how frustrated LeBron is right now for whatever reason. Because I think most NBA players generally kind of tune Chuck out at this point.
So this is the best thing that ever happened to Barkley, is really what you're saying.
I mean, not like the thing I like about Inside the NBA is that they will take all this in good humor, and it won't be this is not going to become some feud that hangs over every Cavs game on TNT going forward. Cavs are on TNT next Monday, actually, against the Wizards. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of opportunities for Barkley to talk about LeBron, and I don't think that there's going to be like this undercurrent of beef the whole time. Let's put it that way. So with that, we should transition to the Celtics. And before we do, I want to say that today's podcast is brought to you by Movement Watches. Movement Watches was founded on the belief that style shouldn't break the bank. The watchmaker's goal is to change the way consumers think about fashion by offering high-quality, minimalist products at revolutionary prices. Movement Watches start at just $95. At a department store, you're looking at $400 to $500. Movement figured out that by selling online, they were able to cut out the middleman and retail markup, providing the best possible price. Ben, you have a Movement Watch. Tell me about your Movement Watch.
I do, and I think the key is what you just said. I mean, $95 starting price point for a watch that you would usually pay $400 to $500 for. There's not really any sacrifice in terms of the quality. If you compare them side by side, you'd think a Movement Watch costs just the same as the other ones. I mean, you're not really giving anything back, and you're getting a lot of savings, and that really owes to their online sort of direct-to-consumer model. I mean, I think it's just a smarter way to do business. It looks clean. You got the adjustable straps. You can, you know, put on a classier one if you need to. You can go more casual if you prefer that route. Nice and versatile. Yeah, I wear it all the time. It's great.
Yeah, they do have a pretty wide selection on there. And you can get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns by going to movementwatches.com/floor. Movement Watches can also be a perfect gift for your Valentine. It is actually a pretty smart gift.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, what better way to impress somebody than give them great value and great look? Go to movementwatches.com/floor. That's MVMTwatches.com/floor. That will get you the discount, and it'll make you a hero on February 14th. So look forward to that.
All right. So now we went top to bottom on LeBron and Barkley. I want to talk Celtics now, because every single mailbag we've done, there's like a couple Celtics questions and we never get to them. And I always feel a little bit bad about it. You don't really like talking about the Celtics, but I'm going to force you to do this for 15 minutes to close out the pod here. So do you want to just go through these questions?
Let's do it. The first question I saw was from Jordan Wilson, and she's from New Zealand. That's actually a big accomplishment for us. We don't have a lot of penetration into either New Zealand or the female marketplace, so that's a that's a double win. She wants to know, what's up with the stat poor Celtics defense? Wasn't their defense supposed to be their real strength? It can't just be Isaiah Thomas's fault. Great point. I mean, we have talked about this a little bit. I mean, Isaiah is tough to cover for, right? He is going to always be an issue. And, you know, it happens all the time. Like the other night I was watching, he was closing out on a shooter. And like when he put his hand up as high as he possibly could, it was still like 6 feet away from where the release point was. And so it's just like there's some things physically he's just not going to be able to do.
Right.
But as we've talked about, he is not the only issue. And they've had some injury problems. I think that's part of the defense. You know, guys like Crowder, Horford, Avery Bradley have kind of been in and out. And that's going to always impact your defensive efficiency numbers if you don't have that continuity. But I think a lot of people are looking at inside as a possible spot for upgrade of the trade deadline, right?
Yeah, I think to answer this question, because there's a couple different ways to look at the Celtics. Just the defense is obviously an issue, but I think the simplest answer is that almost everyone in their rotation has regressed defensively, right? Like Marcus Smart is still excellent on defense, but Avery Bradley's not as good on that end as his reputation. Same with Jay Crowder. Same with Al Horford, who they are now, I mean, he helps their offense, but he is an issue on defense, protecting the rim. And I think they probably expected him to be a little bit better protecting the rim. And then Isaiah is like the one, he was always going to be the weak link. But I think when you roll all those guys out, like it's a problem.
Yeah, I wonder too. We've seen a lot of the teams in the Eastern Conference adopt this, like, our offense is awesome, our defense is okay to just be average, and what are we really fighting for approach. I mean, that Cleveland definitely has been that. Toronto's had that issue. I'm not sure if they can ever really get to an elite defense given their personnel right now.
Yeah.
But I also wonder if some of these teams, you know, given just the nature of the top-heavy league this year, if their defensive numbers at this point are meaningfully below what they're going to be like in a potential postseason series. Like, can't you see Boston, with their current defensive personnel, no trades, playing significantly better defense in a postseason format?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good point. And that's sort of my general feeling with the Celtics at this point in the season. I think they are actually better than a lot of the critics suggest. They're not as good as some of the, like, true believers. The true Tommy Heinsohns out there would have said in the preseason, but they're solid. And in a 7-game series, they're going to be tough. So that's a good point. But I want to get into the meat of the future, because they are kind of at, like, a crossroads here. Next question was from Efro Imchuk. He says, so as a Celtics fan, I was pretty flabbergasted when I heard Sharp completely dismiss Isaiah being the worst defensive player in the league.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Look, I am sticking with the fact that Isaiah's defense is not the issue for the Celtics. But in the spirit of the topic, here's a question for the mailbag. Do the Celtics pay Isaiah whatever it takes when it comes time for contract extension talk? And this is where the Celtics get really interesting to me, because I don't know if you do. I don't know if he, and like, at the same time, he's a cult hero in Boston. Every Celtics fan adores Isaiah Thomas, and they should. But I feel like if you're looking for places where they are not quite as good as they appear, Isaiah is like the number one spot.
Well, I love that we haven't even gotten them to win a single playoff series before we're ready to blow it up.
No, I'm not blowing it up, but I just, the thing with Isaiah is, it's interesting because they're kind of handcuffed to him. Like, they traded for him a few years ago. He was good enough to play them out of the lottery. I'm just not sure if he's good enough to play them into the finals.
Okay, I'm with you on that. Can I say that there's some distinct Damian Lillard vibes to this conversation?
Yeah.
You know, a couple of years ago, you know, Dame's on the ascent. He's beloved. You know, he's Portland's MVP. And that's sort of where Isaiah is right now. Like, Isaiah can do no wrong. He's on this unbelievable contract. He's one of the single best values in the league. You can even make an argument that he's a better value than Steph Curry, which is crazy to think about. But, you know, that's a legitimate conversation you can have. The whole conversation changes once the check increases, right? And we've seen that with Lillard too, is once he's making max money and once you only have a few other max slots to kind of build around him, the expectation level is just not overachieving and being a fun story. It's like legitimately making deep runs and having people believe that you can be the number one guy on a title team.
Right.
And I think that's a completely fair question about Isaiah. It's not only applicable to him. I think you can say that about a lot of the guys in the, you know, second or third tier stars who we've talked about, who just haven't given us a real reason to believe that they're on that super elite level. But that being said, all sorts of those guys get paid max money. I mean, you know, do you think Memphis regrets giving Mike Conley his contract after the way he's played this season?
No, but I also don't think that Memphis is playing for titles the way Boston has claimed to be. You know what I mean?
And I guess my question is that I question the claim as opposed to questioning Isaiah. You know, it's like, really, what are you doing here? You know, especially if they sit on their hands at the deadline. If they're just cool at the deadline, then forget about the claim. I don't believe it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll come back to this. Next question is from David Amoyle. Is there a deal where the Celtics don't think it's too soon to trade Horford? Speaking of blowing it up, he's on a different timeline than the rest, says the question. This is the other wrinkle with the Celtics, is they signed Al Horford thinking that they were getting Kevin Durant, and I'm not sure whether they would have signed Horford if they knew they were not getting KD.
Yeah, I think that they would have, because remember, there's a lot of back history of them like whiffing on everybody.
Yeah,
so I think that a big part of the Horford signing was like, we got one, we did it. You know, it's like validation. And also, they needed to make more upward momentum this season. And I think they have, honestly. When I was going back and looking at some stats for the Celtics, you know, since Horford has been back and healthy, they're a top five record in the league, you know, pretty clearly. Their offense and defense are pretty comparable with Cleveland, you know, since that time period. Now, clearly Cleveland's had some issues. They've been a little shakier than usual, but that's always a standard you're going to be judged by, right?
Right.
So I still think Boston with Horford is better than they look right now in the standings. I still think that, you know, their kind of lag to get up to speed is going to be noticeable just because of the time that he missed. But yeah, it's he hasn't had that major superstar impact, especially defensively, that I expected him to. I mean, he was coming from some excellent defensive teams in Atlanta, and I thought that was going to transfer pretty seamlessly. He's not your traditional, like, Rudy Gobert or Joel Embiid style, like, crazy rim protector, you know, backline guy. But he's still a really quality defender, and that really hasn't played out that way. So
yeah, it's funny.
I can understand the frustration with him, but I don't think that means you have to blow him up, especially because they have so many trade chips, whether it's smaller contracts, medium-sized contracts, future draft picks, whatever. Like, to me, they've got like five guys who I wouldn't really trade before the deadline, but they've got another half of the roster who are all movable, and they've got every pick and sweetener you'd possibly need. So I don't get why you would go to your batch of A players right now as part of a move when you can add some talent, you know, without sacrificing any of them.
I'm with you. I it's funny, like, if we had done this, if we had had this conversation 2 weeks ago, I probably would have approached this by saying that the Celtics are overrated. But at this point, I think enough people are doubting the Celtics to where I think they're actually kind of underrated. And Horford is great as a third best player. He's their second best player right now, and that sort of limits their ceiling a little bit. But I think you definitely keep Horford, if only because add a Paul George or Jimmy Butler, and Horford suddenly looks awesome. And speaking of which, a couple questions here. Cornelius Hoopenstan asks, now that Brooklyn will definitely finish 30th, why don't the C's trade Smart and the Brooklyn pick for Paul George? And then they could get Bogut. And then Mason asks, as a Celtics fan, I don't understand the obsession some have with getting another star. Boogie is the only player discussed that could present a legitimate challenge to LeBron. Shouldn't the Celtics be going after a young, bouncy, rim-running, rebounding big? A lot of great adjectives there. So they can challenge Toronto. So where do you come down? Like, because this is actually a harder decision than it seems. Like, do you go after the superstar now and flip those assets, or do you expect that LeBron is going to win regardless?
You do not expect LeBron is going to win regardless. You just don't. That's a loser's mentality. I've been preaching that for a month. I don't know how available guys like Jimmy Butler and Paul George are, but if you have any shot at them, you should definitely start cashing in those assets to get those guys. Clearly, the last one that you want to part with is this year's Brooklyn pick, because it's on track to be such a ridiculously good, you know, draft slot, and then also just the talent level of this year's draft.
Well, so that's one of the issues, though, is that that pick is now so good that no team is going to be trading a star if they're not getting that Brooklyn pick back. It's just, that's just not going to happen. So the real question is whether you trade the number one pick or a top three pick and go after one of these guys. And like,
okay, so if gun to your head, if you're playing to win titles this year, you do it for sure. If one of those two guys is available, I would do it. I might have a little bit more hesitation about Paul George. He's just kind of had a weird year, and contract wise, it's not such a great spot.
Interesting.
With Jimmy, I would do it.
Okay, so first of all, to answer Mason's question, I definitely think they should be in the market for a rim running, rebounding big. I think one of the issues that they've had is that, like, I don't think it's a good idea to put Nerlens Noel back in Boston. Or I know that certain NBA people probably think that. And so because he's such a clear solution for them, if I were Boston, I would roll the dice and bring him in, because he's
also your favorite player, though.
He's, I think on every other podcast, I suggest the Nerlens trade. But look, Nerlens is out there. He makes so much sense for them. It's worth the risk. And the other question, though, is like, because there's rumors already that Butler could go to the Celtics at the trade deadline. Would you choose Butler? I mean, I think you just said this. You would choose Jimmy Butler over Paul George?
I mean, if it became a situation where the only way I could get a star is parting with that pick, you have to get the guy who's on a longer-term contract. And I think also, in terms of just fitting in personality-wise with guys like Crowder, Avery Bradley. I mean, that is a monster perimeter defensive lineup that you could construct. You could even use Jimmy as like a small ball four against certain lineups, like when Cleveland goes small. You'd have a lot of, you know, spacing, number one, on offense, but then also just the ability to spread things out for Isaiah, switch everything along the perimeter, and then just, you know, have a bunch of dogs out there playing defense. I mean, I think that would really transform their identity. So, yeah, I'd get excited about that.
Yeah.
From Chicago's standpoint, I mean, that would be such a tough pill to swallow. I mean, you're admitting so many mistakes if you trade Jimmy,
aren't you? It's a tough pill to swallow, but if you get a top three pick in this draft, this is the best possible version of Jimmy Butler leaves Chicago. You know what I mean? Like, that would be a pretty solid return.
There's already protests in the street for Gar Pax, and I think that there would be a revolt.
I think my version of this involves a front office house cleaning as well. But I could just like a restart in Chicago seems like it's overdue. I do wonder.
Wouldn't you just love the, hey, we finally got Fred as pace and space point guard. It's Lonzo Ball. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Paul George is not going anywhere until June. So if the Celtics want Paul George, they would have to wait. And they might just decide to roll it over until 2019. I think like we're going to find out a lot about what they want to do in the next few months, because they could make a play for Jimmy Butler now. There's a chance that like they could take the risk that Paul George will be available. I think Paul George is a better fit with Isaiah Thomas long term, because Jimmy Butler needs the ball more than George does.
Yeah, I mean, he's just also a better offensive player, though. And I think, you know, Paul's got some bad habits that are kind of coming out this season. Maybe those bad habits would go away in a more functional environment with some more fine-tuning and deploying him, but I feel like he doesn't get to the rim enough. He doesn't really get to the free throw line enough, settles a lot for jumpers. And a lot of those things that we get angry at John Wall about, Paul George is probably guilty of the same and maybe doesn't catch as much flack for.
He definitely has developed some bad habits. Like his shot selection, he takes a lot of shots that are like Kobe-esque, and he's not that type of shooter. You know what I mean? Like sometimes Durant will take those shots and you're like, well, you're Kevin Durant. That's a pretty decent shot. Or Steph Curry. Paul George is not, he's a good shooter, but he's not that level.
What I'd be envisioning with like Isaiah and Jimmy would be similar to Lowry and DeRozan, only like a souped up, more efficient version.
Yeah. I think if you put Paul George in a better offense with a better coach, he could be like a monster. And I think his ceiling is a little bit higher than Jimmy Butler's. So what would you do? Let's close it out like this. If you were the Celtics, do you make the trade for Butler right now?
I mean, I would part with the number one pick for Butler. I wouldn't part with it for George just because of the contract situation. I would also be exploring every possible avenue, and my main thrust of my approach would be to try to add as much talent as possible without compromising the top five guys on the roster plus that number one pick. Yeah. So I'd be looking at the Millsaps and the Ibakas and anyone else who could provide a little bit more front court defense and better matchups with Cleveland that wouldn't break the bank. That would be really the direction that I'd be going. And I would, you know, test drive Isaiah as this quote-unquote MVP candidate and see how far an Isaiah-driven offense can take you in the postseason. I guess that would be my approach before really getting active in the summer.
Okay. For me, I don't think I would trade for Jimmy Butler. I don't think that team would have that high of a ceiling, particularly against LeBron the next year or two. But even beyond that, I think it's a stranger fit with Isaiah than people realize. And I would wait for Paul George. And if he's available, trade whatever it takes to get him, because he's awesome and he would be great in that offense. And if not, if Paul George isn't available, then roll it over to 2019 and draft someone in this draft and maybe keep next year's Nets pick and just sort of like play for the future, because they do have a lot of flexibility and it's not worth going after a B plus guy.
Yeah. So just real quick on the fit with Jimmy and Isaiah. I mean, I think personality wise, that could get to be an issue. But I think basketball wise, like if they could kind of reach a consensus about how they're going to do it off the court, I think it could work really well on the court, because I think Jimmy is better off not being your lead point guard. I think given Chicago's point guard options, he should be their point guard, but you'd rather have a primary ball handler. That'd be Isaiah. Isaiah is great at creating space. He's super efficient in terms of, you know, his shot selection. Like, he gets to the free throw line, gets to the rim, and he's a good three-point shooter. And then Jimmy has a secondary threat where he's able to attack a weak side defense and get to the free throw line and just kind of punish them, like I was saying, sort of like DeMar-like. That could really work. And then you could always have one of them on the court, so you could stagger their minutes a little bit, so now you don't have the droughts where you're like praying for Marcus Smart to carry you through, you know, some stretches. I mean, I think that could be pretty potent.
The gist of my theory is that you can't come through these 4 or 5 years with all these assets and not come away with a star. So it'll be interesting. Can I ask one final question? Short answer, and we can close this off.
Please.
The Wizards are playing really well. Why aren't more people mentioning them as a potential destination for Melo?
For Melo? Oh.
Look.
Well, we don't want to ruin it, maybe?
I mean, they are lurking, and of all the teams that have been mentioned, they are kind of the only one that doesn't sound miserable. I guess if the Clippers can add Melo for Austin Rivers, fine. But I think if I were the Knicks, I would rather have a first-round pick and Kelly Oubre and salary filler.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was going to ask. So who is the salary filler? What's your dream deal? Because I know you've got it queued up on the trade machine.
Well, they would have to include Mahinmi. And maybe the Knicks don't want to pay Jan Mahinmi and Joakim Noah.
Twin Towers. Yeah, I was going to say Twin Towers, Noah and Mahinmi. That'd be great.
Yeah. So, maybe the Wizards could find a third team to take Mahinmi. It's just, it's out there. The Wizards are playing well enough now that it would make a decent amount of sense for them to bet on Melo. I'm almost worried saying that out loud. And Carmelo's playing at Verizon Center tonight, but it's just something that was on my mind. I was at Knicks shoot around this morning, and we'll see. You know what I mean?
Well, here's my question. Are you going to start him, or is he going to be your sixth man?
I've thought about it. It would be amazing if he would accept the sixth man role, but I think if you have to, like, because that's what he should be. Melo should be playing 25 minutes
ridiculous.
A game. He 25 minutes a game off the bench, close with the starters. It would be perfect. But I think even if you traded for him and then move Markieff Morris to the bench and played either Melo or Otto could probably play the 4-2. Like, they would be in decent shape, and there'd be a lot of firepower.
I mean, you got to start Otto, and so now does he want to play power forward? I mean, that's always been an issue for him. I guess my thing was, the reason why I brought that up, there, I don't know if you saw this public negotiating that was going on during the Clippers game on national television last week, but there was this big discussion by the broadcast team about whether if the Clippers added Melo, whether they would really be willing to lose Luke Richard and Bamute's amazing defense in the starting lineup. So Melo, remember my whole thing about Melo's stock just like flying down? Not only is his stock dropping so fast that he's now in this Austin Rivers conversation of trade value, but the Clippers are weighing whether they should start him or Mbamute if they do trade
exactly.
for him.
Exactly. And keep in mind, I'm proposing a Jan Mahinmi and Kelly Oubre trade for Carmelo Anthony. So stock, it's been a rough couple of months for Carmelo stock. But we will be back on Friday. Thank you for bearing with us as we wade through LeBron and Barkley and the Celtics. And we've got a mailbag coming Friday, so hit us up with questions. It should be fun.
Yeah, take your best LeBron-style jabs at either me or Sharp and your questions so that we can some clips.
Yeah,
and we can unload some clips back at you, listeners. No, but thanks for tuning in. 5-star reviews on iTunes. Be sure to check out MVMTWatches.com/floor. Get yourself a nice watch for Valentine's Day.
I'll talk to you soon, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.